If we stop to carefully analyze the traits which Homer tries to exemplify in Odysseus, I think we'll find that they are fairly well the same ones we cherish today as part of our culture. I'm not going to ask any of you to consider doing such a thing, but rather the assignment for a week from Monday will be a rewrite of some incident in the Odyssey using our own vernacular and substituting a very American hero for the Greek warrior. This is the way I want you to go about it.
Then will our youth dwell in a land of health, amid fair sights and sounds, and receive the good in everything.
Among the names which crowd into the field of education, one I will always remember is that of Dr. Ernest Horne. In connection with reading, his name was frequently coupled with that of Miss Maud McBroom. I knew Miss McBroom. She was our principal. And I vaguely even knew Dr. Horne, for he was director of University Elementary. But more obvious was my connection with Dr. Horne through Horne Ashbaugh, Fundamentals of Spelling. That maroon book with the black band about it lay in my desk from grade 1 through 8. It was considered a completely new speller. It held a new philosophy of learning words and a new philosophy of the words to be learned. Dr. Ernest Horne had been quite explicit in his direction.
All right, fifth grade, the red books, the spellers. Today we'll have the monthly review lesson. In other words, 40 instead of the usual 20 words for the week. But before we get started on the regular routine, Johnny, suppose you come up here and read what the spelling book has to say about why fifth graders should be good spellers.
Fifth grade pupils are expected to write a great many more letters, as well as a great many more compositions than do the pupils of grade 4. The lessons for fifth grade contain the words which fifth grade children are most likely to need to write. Each of these words is also one which you will need to write all your life. If you will do your part, this book will help you to become an excellent speller. However, you must work hard. There is no easy way to become a good speller.
All right, now, we know our aim, and we know how we're going to go about reaching it. However, since Lois is new to the class and has probably never used the Horne-Ashbaugh method of spelling, I'm going to suggest that Patsy Grothaus go with her into that far corner of the room and explain to her in detail just how we go about this job. The rest of you will start in on the new words, orally pronouncing each one after me, watching carefully the syllables. And if you aren't sure of the correct use or meaning of a word, have me use it in a sentence. Risk.
Risk.
Forgotten.
Forgotten.
Product.
Product.
You see, Lois, after all the words have been pronounced, we'll have a written test to find out which words we can't spell. The words we each miss are the ones which we'll study, see?
Yeah, then I won't have to study all 20 words on the list.
Not unless you miss all 20 of them. You already know how to spell those you didn't miss, so why study them? Tomorrow you'll study your hard words, then on Wednesday we'll have a review. If you don't miss any words then, you won't have to study during Thursday's spelling period, but can work on your puppet or read.
Then I wouldn't have to take Friday's test either.
Yes, you would. Just to be sure you really have learned how to spell all the words. We always aim to get 100% by Friday at least.
Okay, I've got it. But what about those extra 20 words?
Well, once a month we have 20 extra words that, well, were especially hard for everyone the first time we had them. Sort of review, you know.
That all?
No, we've a special way of studying the misspelled words. First, you've got to know how to pronounce the wrong word correctly, saying each syllable very distinctly and looking closely at each syllable as you say it. And then with closed eyes, try to see the word in your book, syllable by syllable, as you pronounce it in a whisper.
Like, forgotten?
Uh-huh. Then spell it in a whisper.
F-O-R-G-O-T-T-E-N.
Open your eyes and look at the word. Is it right?
Yeah.
If it weren't, then you'd have to go back over those steps. But now you can try writing, without looking at your book, of course. Is it right?
Uh-huh.
Mm, good. Now you don't have to try again. If you can spell it right 3 times in a row now, you've got it learned.
Gee, I guess I understand.
Ah, the instructions are in the book if you get stuck. Come on, Lois. They're almost ready to begin the writing. Oh, I forgot. You gotta spell the word right the very first time. You can't erase or write over, and your writing's gotta be readable or it counts off.
Pencils and papers, ready? First word, risk. Risk.
There, you know exactly how I learned all my fundamental spelling. Just let it be known, university high schoolers are quite a sophisticated group of test takers. Among the numerous batteries of exams we encountered were a yearly group known as the Iowa Every Pupil Tests of Basic Skill.
Today, we're going to take a test of silent reading ability. I shall now pass out the test booklets. Place them on your desks with title page up and wait until I give further directions. It says...
Gee whiz, rats, these things again. Don't they ever get tired of correcting tests around here?
Makes it extra easy when you've got a special agency all just for correcting over in the university. And you know whose dad runs this Iowa Every Pupil Test stuff.
Yeah, Louise's dad, E.F. Lindquist.
Well, don't just kick Dr. Lindquist. Look who makes out the things. Our own dear teachers, H.F. Spitzer and Ernest Horn and Maud McBroom. And don't think that Price and Hafner and Carpenter don't contribute, too.
Sure enough. And you'd think with our own teachers writing those tests, we'd breeze through them easy. But, oh, no, we chew our pencils just like the poor peoples in all the other Iowa high schools who benefit by these things.
Oh, we may be glad someday. We can be thankful they're objective and not essay-type tests.
We just happen to know the awful part about the Iowa Every Pupil Test, the taking of them.
Remember this test of study skills. You are to do page 10 first and then turn back to page 1. You will have 29 minutes for part 1, that's map reading. Now we are ready to begin. If any of you have any questions, raise your hand, and I'll help you after the others have begun. Ready? Go.
How does the distance above sea level at A compare with that at N? A is higher, N is higher. Oh. We had hopes when we completed junior high school that our days of achievement tests of the Iowa Every Pupil variety were over. But oh no. In the fall of 1942, Dr. E.F. Lindquist initiated a new fall testing program for Iowa high schools. Naturally, as takers, we weren't open-minded enough to realize the implications of Dr. Lindquist's work. To realize it was giving a fair key to our abilities and achievements and indicating improvements needed within the curriculum or teaching procedures. Only those of us in the university schools weren't the only ones to suffer. For once the tests had been standardized, duplicates were sent about Iowa and other parts of the United States. Among other projects to which our teachers contributed was the designing of study units designed for student participation through discussions and special activities, and with few teacher lectures and single textbook reading. As a result, the emphasis was on how to think, not so much on what to think. Neither we nor the teachers were afraid of controversial issues, and we always had lots of opinions, specialized in variety, and never were at a loss for questions. For example, Dr. John H. Hafner, in 1940, worked up a source unit for social studies called Housing America, which was widely distributed by the National Council for Social Studies. I know for certain my class contributed to that study, for in the front of the pamphlet is a picture taken on our well-remembered field trip to a substandard housing area.
Phew, this is pretty bad. Mr. Hafner said this would be an eye-opening trip, and I really believe it.
And this isn't as bad as some of the sections in really big industrial cities either.
Makes you want to kick somebody for letting things get into such a state.
Probably, but who are you going to kick?
Well, first off, industry, I guess.
The industry's answer is always, we can't afford to spend money on the workers. They get paid the wage we can afford and still make substantial enough profit to suit our shareholders.
But they could afford it if they'd just stop and realize that better living conditions would mean better and more productive workers. If they'd just stop to figure out how many man-hours could be saved if the workers were in good health...
Think how much better off the factories would be if they had more intelligent men working for them. If they'd improve the living condition, the people's IQs would go up.
Oh, no, that couldn't happen. Their IQs wouldn't change, Lois, but they might.
Their IQs would, too, change.
Oh, they couldn't, Lois. An IQ you're born with, and when you finally reach a certain age, you can't get any more intelligent.
You're wrong, Pat. Training can be changed a lot, so poor environment would certainly mean that the IQ is lower than it would have to be.
That wouldn't work. Since an IQ is hereditary, it would always stay the same, or the average wouldn't always be 100.
I know it does change, because my father was talking about it just the other day.
Well, my dad says it's constant, and he knows something about psychology, too.
Here, here. I think you girls will find this IQ problem is yet to be solved. The Child Welfare Department in Iowa City has found out some very interesting things about the IQ, and consequently has been disagreeing with many specialists who have come to other conclusions. I'll tell you, both of you investigate the cases your fathers present and bring your reports to class Monday. Oh, Chuck's going to take a picture over here. Suppose we get in it.
When you do find out the IQ, then some people think it'll always stay the same way. That it indicates a given intelligence capacity, and it can't get any better or any worse without something physical being wrong in your brain. That'd mean IQ was inherited and environment and training couldn't possibly change it.
But the Child Welfare Department here found on some tests they gave the preschoolers, the first clear back in the days when we were there, that over the time between entering the school in the fall and when they left for summer vacation, the kids gained in IQ. Incidentally, a matched group of non-preschool children didn't make any gains.
But that might have been really only a difference in how the children were taking the test felt toward the person giving the test. Maybe the teacher was friends with the kids by spring, so they did better.
They thought of that, and they made some kinds of check to be sure. And they keep giving these tests, too, to each new group each year, and the same results come out.
In other words, it would seem that the Child Welfare Department has found that though the IQ is relatively constant or unchangeable, it can be altered by some forms of training. But under what conditions and to what extent has not been determined.
Yeah, but they keep trying to find out how much is the test.
Our regular teachers were exceptionally competent and have been carefully selected that they might not only give us a good educational background, but further contribute to the perfection of more and better teachers for all Iowa through their leadership, example, and suggestions. The Child Welfare Station and the University Experimental Schools could never hope to fulfill their triple purposes of demonstration, research, and training without the close cooperation of all the various departments of psychology, Child Welfare, Philosophy, the whole College of Liberal Arts, and of course, the College of Education. I've not been able to express all the units which branch from these fields into the broad aspect of full education. I've missed such familiar words as Patrick, Fellows, Spence, Hall, Jessup, Seashore, Packer, Kirby, Stoddard, Wellman, and Peterson. But I hope I have at least left some impression of one way in which the university has contributed generously to the fundamental science of education in its broad sense, and has already given Iowa an impetus towards a very definite leadership in the fine art of rearing children.
You have listened to the sixth in the series of centennial broadcasts, which has been presented by the State University of Iowa. Those taking part in the program were Herb Olson, Herb Kanzel, Sybil Rickless, Lenore Morford, Marilyn Highlander, and Pat Grothaus, who also wrote the script. Clay Harshbarger directed. Next week at this same time, the State University of Iowa invites you to listen to the seventh in this series. At that time, we will present an adaptation of Wilbur Schramm's recently published story, The Voice in the Earphones.